This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guest today is Winona Halter, Executive Director of Food and Water Watch, a D.C.-based environmental watchdog organization. Winona has worked extensively on food, water, energy, and environmental issues at the national, state, and local level, and is the author of Foodopoly. Winona Halter is here to tell us about her most recent book, Fracopoly, The Battle for the Future of Energy and the Environment, published in 2016. Welcome, Winona.
I'm so glad to be here.
What is your purpose in writing Fracopoly?
Well, at Food and Water Watch, we have been campaigning to ban fracking now for about 5 years. We started getting calls in 2007, 2008 from our members and supporters alerting us to what was happening in their communities. And we started looking into it and were very concerned about it and became the first national group to call for a ban on fracking. I decided to write Fracopoly because I thought that we needed to be making more progress towards sustainability. We're not producing enough renewable energy or using energy efficiency technologies the way that we should.
Would you remind listeners of exactly what fracking is and what it involves?
Yes, fracking is an extreme energy method of drilling for oil and gas. It uses a science fiction-like process where large amounts of water, chemicals, and fine sand are injected deep in the earth to release oil and gas. They drill about 2 miles into the ground and then drill another tunnel horizontally almost as far. And then they use this fracking process, the injecting under high pressure, in multiple stages to fracture the shale and to release the oil and gas.
How extensive is fracking in the U.S. at present?
Well, it's taking place in more than 30 states. Of course, because of fracking, there's been overproduction, and so there are fewer rigs than there were, but the prices are now beginning to go back up. And we expect to see the rigs back fracking in many of the areas where fracking has been going on since around the turn of the 21st century.
In what states is most of the fracking taking place?
Well, it's taking place in a number of states. Fracking really began in places like Texas and Pennsylvania, and fracking is going on in those states in places like West Virginia. California is a place where fracking is taking place. But of course, fracking affects most of the country because of the infrastructure that has to be developed. The hundreds of thousands of miles of pipelines, the liquefied natural gas plants, the oil terminals, and of course, the accidents that go with the transportation of oil, like the one that you recently had in the Columbia Gorge out here in the Northwest.
How many companies are involved in fracking?
Well, there are about 20 major companies. But one of the reasons that I wrote Fracopoly is to point out how the major oil and gas companies, and those are companies that most people know their names, Exxon is the largest fracker, Chevron, Shell, BP, they are amongst the 10 largest fracking companies. And the American majors like Exxon and Chevron, over the course of the last 150 years, have had a lot to do with how our laws have been really rigged to benefit the oil and gas industry. And of course, there were about 4 or 5 major oil companies. They've now consolidated, but American companies over that period of time that really impacted our regulatory regime for oil and gas. And a lot of the laws that have actually led to fracking being allowed today.
In your book, you go back to the very beginnings in regard to discoveries of natural gas. What were the beginnings?
Well, natural gas was noticed in Greece thousands of years ago. And in places like Pennsylvania in the 1800s, people saw natural gas. It was, in fact, developed on a small level to do heating and other types of low-level energy needs. But I would say that Pennsylvania was really ground zero for the production of natural gas in the beginning. And of course, oil and gas are often found together. And so all of the drilling that we saw in Texas and other places in the country, gas was associated with it.
How did fracking begin?
Well, fracking, really the technologies that came together to make fracking possible, many of them were developed through the use of our federal tax dollars. And while there are energy interests like T. Boone Pickens, who people might know his name, who say, I've been fracking for 50 years. Well, that's not quite accurate. The oil industry used water and some type of pressure at not a very deep level to release oil. But the real technologies that allowed fracking to take place came together around in the 1990s. And that's when we began to see fracking really experimented with. And really about in 2000 is when we really saw the massive use of fracking. And since that time, well, since 2012, 80% of the fracking has been for oil, actually, not natural gas.
In terms of the natural gas, there's been this idea that it's a bridge fuel in terms of going from fossil fuels to clean energy. How did this idea come forward?
Yes, well, I think that the natural gas industry, really the oil industry, because they are one and the same, has been very smart in how they approached environmentalists, especially beginning in the 1990s when the deregulation of the electric industry began, the rewriting of the rules of the electric industry to create a wholesale market for electricity. And because natural gas electric plants can be built rather quickly, there were a lot of economic interests that were interested in being able to sell this electricity into the market utilities would be getting the energy from. And they approached a lot of environmentalists, and some were even funded, to look at the use of natural gas, because when it's burnt, it produces about half of the carbon that coal does. But unfortunately, they weren't looking at the other greenhouse emissions that take place from natural gas. Natural gas is methane, and over the first 20 years after it's emitted, it's about 100 times more potent a greenhouse gas. That's important because, of course, with the likelihood that we're reaching the tipping point for real devastating climate change, we have to do something in the next 10 to 15 years. So the fact that methane is such a potent greenhouse gas means that it's really not sustainable. It's not a bridge fuel, not to mention that building another 40 years of infrastructure for the natural gas industry means that the industry doesn't recognize it as a bridge fuel. They want another 40 years of fossil fuel use.
How does natural gas compare with coal as far as climate change issues?
Well, there's recent science that shows that the whole drilling, transporting, processing of natural gas makes it as dangerous as coal. And this is the point I was making a few minutes ago, because it is such a potent greenhouse gas. And there's been studies that have come out of Cornell now looking at natural gas in this 20-year time frame, and there's great concern. We really need to keep fossil fuels in the ground. And also, natural gas leaks so tremendously. The methane, it's an odorless, invisible gas, and it turns out the EPA has way undercounted emissions of natural gas.
If the leakage could be controlled, to what extent would that help?
Well, first of all, we don't believe that it can be controlled. One of the things that I learned in studying the last 140 years of the oil and gas industry is they always cut corners. Cutting corners is their business model. The likelihood that they are going to go back and stop this leakage is very improbable, especially since the Obama administration has released rules on methane leakage, and they are grandfathering in all of the existing infrastructure, all 140,000 wells that have been fracked. And then there are all those wells from conventional drilling that haven't been plugged that need to be plugged to keep the methane from being emitted. I mean, this is a real crisis.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Winona Halter, Executive Director of Food and Water Watch and author of the book, Fracopoly, The Battle for the Future of Energy and the Environment. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. What has been documented about the impacts of fracking on water availability and quality?
Well, fracking uses 50 times more water on average than conventional drilling. When you look at wells, the average well uses at least 1.7 million gallons of water, and sometimes wells in Texas use up to 13 million gallons. So there's a lot of water usage. A lot of fracking is taking place in dry, water-stressed areas of the country. And the water is then polluted with these terrible chemicals. And in fact, there are about, on average, 10.5 billion gallons of water every day that are surging up out of the wells, polluted water that has to be dealt with. So it's really terrible. And in dry places like California, where, of course, there's recently been a horrible drought, we've found out that fracking wastewater is being used to water crops, which is pretty shocking.
What generally does happen to the wastewater from the fracking?
Well, it depends on what part of the country. In some areas, like in Pennsylvania, a lot of the water is stored in holding ponds, and they've had a real crisis on what to do with the wastewater. In many other parts of the country, it's injected deep underground, called deep well injection, and it's caused swarms of earthquakes. In fact, in states such as Oklahoma, that used to have maybe one or two 3.0 magnitude earthquakes a year, they've been having more than 5,000 a year. And it's well documented that this injection of wastewater is causing earthquakes. And that's happening in several parts of the country.
You said a bit about this earlier, but what are the impacts of fracking infrastructure on the environment and communities, for example, the pipelines that are built?
Well, there are so many impacts. Besides wasting billions of dollars of money and ensuring that we're going to be stuck with fossil fuel use into the future, building pipelines has a lot of environmental impacts. It fragments forests. It means that large swaths of forests, sometimes pristine rural areas, are clear cut for the right of way to build the pipes. They cross streams, rivers, and creeks, and there's a real impact on these waterways just from the building of the pipelines. Often there are spills, and pipelines corrode, and they have accidents. So there are a lot of impacts. And there is also the problem, of course, of the leakage of methane from these pipelines. And they're going through people's farms, near their homes. There's the possibility of explosions. There have been many pipeline accidents over the past 20 years.
How has fracking affected communities where the fracking takes place?
Well, people have so many health effects from living near these fracking sacrifice areas. And I want to say that today, 17 million people live within a mile of a well. First of all, there are impacts on drinking water because the casings from the wells often leak. There's about a 30% chance that a well casing is going to be somehow weakened and allow the methane to get into aquifers. We don't really know what goes on deep underground, a couple of miles underground. We don't know all of the impacts, but we do know that a lot of people have problems with their drinking water, and their drinking water will have a matching imprint of the methane that's being drilled nearby. And there are also many chemicals because the frackers can use up to 400 different chemicals, many of them carcinogenic, things like benzene, all sorts of solvents, and this ends up in the drinking water. And then there are the processing facilities. There are a lot of chemicals that are emitted out of these processing facilities, a whole list related to the chemicals that are used in the fracking process and then the hydrocarbons themselves. People get sick when they live near these facilities, and they have high levels of air pollution. And this is well documented.
To what extent has the government supported and encouraged the development of fracking?
Well, sadly, almost since the beginning, and I'm talking about the beginning of the 20th century, there's been real support for using fossil fuels. Figure that in 1913, the research began for the use of oil and gas and the improvement of drilling. As I mentioned before, many of the fracking technologies were actually developed with our tax dollar money. And then there is the undue influence that these companies have had over our democracy, over all of the rules and regulations that they must abide by or not abide by. And what's happened over time is they have either been exempted from or have conspired to not obey our nation's antitrust laws, which allowed them to become larger and larger and larger and more politically powerful. And then in the 1980s, they helped elect Ronald Reagan, who basically eviscerated our antitrust laws, which is where the opoly part of the book Frackopoly comes from. Because when companies get too big, they have too much influence over our democracy. And so it's been a very sad story. And today, even though we all know that our global climate is being impacted by the use of fossil fuels, we see politicians, our elected representatives, either declaring that there is no climate change or saying that they're taking action on climate change, but the actions that they're taking are just not enough and not fast enough.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Winona Halter, Executive Director of Food and Water Watch and author of the book Frackopoly, The Battle for the Future of Energy in the Environment. What regulations are currently in place for fracking?
Well, in 2005, under the Bush administration, the Energy Policy Act passed. It passes about every 5 years. And this legislation had an exemption that many people know about, the Halliburton loophole, that actually exempted oil and gas operations from our Safe Drinking Water Act. But what most people don't know is that there were a couple of other important policy measures in that legislation. One was the elimination of a 1935 law that protected communities, consumers, the environment from electric and gas utilities that were too big to fail. And it's allowed the creation of about 20 giant electric companies that also engage in the gas business and are pushing full steam ahead to develop a natural gas and natural gas-fired electric plants. So that happened because of this 2005 law. And the other thing that happened is the regulatory agency that oversees the building of pipelines and electric power lines, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, was given a new power to basically allow the oil and gas industry to fast-track building pipes, liquefied natural gas plants, and other infrastructure. And they were given the right to oversee environmental assessments or the fulfilling of one of our nation's most important environmental laws, the National Environmental Policy Act. And of course, they are subverting this law. And although they have now rejected a couple of big infrastructure projects here in the Northwest and a pipeline, mostly they have never seen an oil and gas project that they don't love. So that has helped fast track fracking and this overproduction of oil and gas. The Obama administration, sadly, has been very friendly to fracking and to natural gas. The Clean Power Plan that the administration put out does incentivize using natural gas for electricity production. The Obama administration did start some investigations in the water pollution in Pennsylvania, Wyoming, and Texas, but before the 2012 election, all of those investigations were closed down. And overall, the Obama administration really hasn't done its job regarding this industry, and the EPA has been extremely weak in doing its job.
Would you characterize the community efforts in the U.S. to ban fracking? How extensive are they?
They are very extensive. And, you know, there is a huge movement that's grown up to ban fracking, to keep fossil fuel in the ground. We've had a lot of victories in recent years, banning fracking in New York, moratorium in Maryland, 500 different community measures to either ban fracking or some kind of moratorium. Of course, out here in the Northwest, all of the activities to stop the infrastructure development with many successes. There's a huge movement, and I think you can tell that the political power of the movement is growing because, of course, fracking has become a major issue in the Democratic campaign for the presidential nomination. So we need to continue growing, but you can see that there is a very vital and exciting movement. And our movement is going to be gathering in Philadelphia the day before the Democratic convention for a march for a clean energy revolution. And we're expecting thousands of people to come and declare their independence from fossil fuels and to keep this movement going and growing stronger because, of course, no matter who's elected president, we need a movement that really works to keep fossil fuels in the ground and works towards the 2018 congressional elections when we need some major changes in Congress.
What efforts are being made globally to ban fracking?
Well, there are efforts all across the world to stop the oil and gas industry. From South Africa to places like Bulgaria that actually banned fracking to Europe, the European Parliament has passed a resolution of concern about fracking, and so far activists there have managed to really curtail the oil and gas industry's efforts to frack in the European Union, although there are some problem areas. In Britain, there is a big activist movement all over the UK. In fact, where fracking is being proposed, activists are campaigning against it. Now, that isn't to say that we don't need to do more organizing. There's a lot more that can be done, but this is definitely a global movement. And every year there is what's called a global frackdown where there are activities during the same month or same week of the year.
What are your recommendations in regard to fracking? What are the best steps to take?
Well, I think we need people to influence their elected officials. You know, part of it depends on where you live. There is a lot of infrastructure being developed, and it's very important that communities do stand up and not let the infrastructure go through. We need to ban fracking. We need to ban fossil fuel use. We really need to do everything that we can to advocate for a very fast transition. I mean, that's really why I wrote Frackopoly. I think that it's shocking that we are only generating 5% of our electricity from wind and solar. And if you include geothermal, it's about 5.5%. We need to act much faster. The market is not going to do it alone. We need the public policies that are going to force this fast transition. And that's why, you know, we're organizing this clean energy revolution. We need to do all of the things to stop the Koch brothers, the oil and gas industry, the companies that are trying to undo the work that we've already done to move into a renewable future, things like the renewable portfolio standards that are being weakened in many states. There is an attack on net metering where people with solar power, solar on their roof, can sell back the energy to a utility. That's under attack. So we need to put this movement together and fight for the things that matter. And there are a lot of opportunities to do that. We always invite people to join us at Food and Water Watch. We have a lot of ways that people can get involved in this clean energy revolution.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Get involved. We do need a political revolution, and we know that we can grow one. It just takes us all together working towards these goals of sustainability.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Winona.
Thank you so much for having me.
You were just listening to Winona Halter, Executive Director of Food and Water Watch and author of the book Fracopoly, The Battle for the Future of Energy and the Environment, published in 2016 by The New Press. For more information, check on the web at winonahalter.org. That's winonahalter.org. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and on kexp.org.